Bigfoot, Nessie, Chupacabra. Are these and other purported monsters the real deal? Are they really not more than a fantasy of those who want to believe? We'll ask those questions on The Cryptid Report. Welcome to The Cryptid Report. I am Jim Harold. So glad to be with you once again. And I was just mentioning to our guest how much I appreciate it when an academic takes a serious look at some of the topics that we cover. And we are talking today with Dr. Michael Lorenzen. He is a professor and librarian at Western Illinois University, where he's the coordinator of archives and special collections for the Western Illinois University Libraries. He has written over 40 articles and book chapters that have appeared in peer-reviewed scholarly publications. He's taught several credit and non-credit courses on cryptids for both Western Washington University and Western Illinois University. He has also been interested in cryptids ever since he watched Andre the Giant appear as Bigfoot on an episode of The $6 Million Man. When he was a little boy, I was probably watching at the same time. He is currently active in collecting Bigfoot narratives from witnesses in West Central Illinois and has spoken on multiple podcasts, including The Riverlands and Wild Quincy. And we're so glad to have Dr. Michael Lorenzen with us today. Sir, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So let's go back to Andre the Giant. Is that where all this started for you? You're interested in cryptid creatures?
Well, it'd be really difficult to pinpoint an exact moment. That's certainly one of my strongest memories from childhood, and being very interested in Bigfoot and that episode of the Bionic Man, and then some of the follow-up episodes they did later. But I also remember watching things like In Search Of and and Leonard Nimoy narrating the Bigfoot episode, which I've gone back and watched as an adult and still enjoyed watching that. I'm seeing some of the other things that came out at the time. You know, that was really fascinating to me. It really got me excited about the whole topic and something I continue to pay attention to and read books about. I think probably one of the stronger moments I have getting interested in this was a book I read when I was little. We had something that come in the mail every month called the Popcorn Pack, and it had a variety of activities in it. And there'd always be a couple books. And one of the books that came was The Boy Who Saw Bigfoot, written by Marianne T. Place. And that book just fascinated me. I read that book over and over and over again. And it really made an impact on me and made me realize, you know, how much literature given to children can really have an impact on their lives. And so it really fit my career later as a librarian, you know, realizing that. But that another moment really got me interested in cryptids and Bigfoot in particular.
That's really interesting. We just recently did an interview with Kyle Sullivan, who is a children's book author, and he just wrote a book, Bigfoot versus Aliens, and like us, he had a interest in both as a child. So I just think that's really interesting how we bring those childhood interests into our adult lives, and that is a question, because a lot of people would have, you know, if they're going into academia and so forth, they would say, okay, I was interested in this stuff as a kid, and that's fine, and that's great. But now I'm a serious adult, and I'm going into the hallowed halls of academia, and I'm going to leave this behind. Why and how did you decide to say, no, I'm not going to leave it behind. I'm going to bring it along with me and incorporate it into my teaching and incorporate it into my research?
And I'm going to say one thing that really has made this easy for me is I'm a librarian. Being an academic librarian means I'm not in the biology department, and I'm not in the sciences. And when I do research in this, it doesn't look as bad necessarily for the university, I would say. Because when I'm going out there and I'm talking and teaching about critical thinking and how to do library research, if I choose to do this with Bigfoot, people think that's neat. It's okay. It's a good, even maybe publicity PR point for the university. I'm not publishing articles claiming that Bigfoot is real or trying to investigate it in a way that might embarrass the university. So I think that I have a different academic experience than I think a lot of academics do. But I can certainly speak some more about how I think Bigfoot is perceived in the academy. I'll do that more in a little bit. But in answer to your question, how I started incorporating this, when I was at Western Washington University, that we had a course on how to do research. Just a basic how to use a library course how to write a paper, how to get research done. And I went ahead and taught a section of it that had a writing emphasis that would fulfill the university's requirement for writing, because I had to take so many writing courses. And I decided to use the topic of cryptids, because that's something that really interests me. So I designed a course where I would have the students come into the library, and we'd meet several times a week for the entire quarter. And we would do all aspects of library research. But instead of just researching anything, I had the students pick a cryptid. Mm-hmm. So what would you like to research? So a lot of them, we're in Northwest Washington, they did Bigfoot. But I had others do Loch Ness Monster. I had someone do mermaids. I had a variety of cryptid species that they did research. And then every stage in the library, we went through, okay, we're going to the archives today. How would we do research for this cryptid in the archives? Now we're looking at the journal literature. How would we look at this? You know, how do we find legitimate scholarly literature on Bigfoot and mermaids versus, you know, Disney's Little Mermaid?
Sure.
Or, you know, something good. How do we distinguish between it? So I had them build a paper on their topic, going through all the different steps of doing the research. So I taught them how to do the library, how to do a research paper. At the same time, we were studying cryptids. And then I had them do a presentation on it. And we also threw in some other things on critical thinking. You know, I had them, okay, so if there was a conspiracy to cover up this cryptid, how would you do it? So we talked about how people develop and talk about conspiracy theories, and they would put all the different points in there. You know, you always have to come up with a profit problem, you know, follow the money. You always have to come up with, you know, scientists are corrupt and they can be paid off to hide evidence, but they can't be paid enough to like reveal that they took the money. You know, how do you construct a theory around it? You know, so they came up with some pretty creative, inventive conspiracy theories too. So, I mean, we came up with a couple of different things. I thought taught critical thinking, taught about how to write a research paper, taught how to do the library. And it worked really well. And I taught that course several times. I always had a waiting list from students who wanted to take the course. I really enjoyed teaching it. When I came to Western Illinois University, my situation was a little different. I came in as dean of the libraries rather than a regular faculty member. So I didn't have nearly as much classroom time, but I did work with the late Dr. Patricia Anderson and designing our anthropology course, Anthropology 215, which was on ancient aliens, Bigfoot, and shapeshifters, which was basically, we talked about pseudo-archaeology and some of the claims people make about things like werewolves and Bigfoot. And of course, just kind of broke down those topics and looked at them from a overview and scientific viewpoint. And I was happy to help her develop the course, and I did the Bigfoot sections of the class, and I also talked to the parts about how to actually do research, you know, how to get into the library, how to look up these topics and find good sources. And then after she died, and I was no longer dean of libraries, I became head of archives, I continued working with this class with a new instructor, and I've done a couple of lectures for him in the class. I'm happy to still be working with that particular class. I've also developed a non-credit course, which I've offered to the community through our Western Life program called Bigfoot in Illinois, where we talk about Bigfoot sightings in Illinois and the local area, and we go over the stuff that I have. And the community really likes that one. It's been a popular class, and I've met a lot of people from doing that. One thing I did get was, after I taught this course, I was invited to the YMCA outdoor show mm-hmm. here in town. Mm-hmm. So I went down and I gave a presentation on some of the same themes to the audience at the YMCA. And when I was done, I had an older gentleman approach me, and he said, "Well, you know, I saw one of those. it was on my property." He told me a story about what happened. You know, it was about 12, 15 minutes out of town, over by Argyle Lake State Park. And he told me a story about how he'd been having all kinds of problems with chickens disappearing from his back, where he had a chicken coop. And he couldn't figure it out. So he put a light out there, motion detector light. And one night he heard a commotion out there, and he looked and he saw, he said, a big ape and had a chicken under its arm.
Wow.
And it took off. And he said, since I've done that, it's not been back. I said, okay, that's interesting. What do you want me to do about it? And he says, well, I just wanted someone to hear me. Someone who's in the university, who has a doctorate, you know, faculty person, but I don't want anybody coming out to my property. I don't want any attention. And I just wanted to be heard. I said, I understand that. So I asked him, can I at least write down your story and put it in the archives? And he said that would be fine, but he didn't want to be identified. And for many reasons, that's problematic for me. I do not like having unidentified stories. I don't want people thinking I'm making them up. So I've been very careful to give permission to record stories since then when I've taken them. But it got me thinking, you know, I'm talking about this. People are interested in telling their stories. I might as well write these down. I'm an archivist. We collect local history. What we ought to be doing is if people have Bigfoot stories and they want to share them, we should record those and transcribe those and put those in our archives too as a part of local history. Regardless if Bigfoot is real or not, people are having these experiences. They have stories. And I think in the future, 20, 50, 100, 500 years from now, people might want to hear what people are seeing in West Central Illinois. And so that's why I've been willing to collect these stories as part of our archives mission. As a university archives, we're not out there doing Bigfoot research full time. That's not what we're doing.
Right.
We collect stories. And this is with falls within the scope of what we do as an academic institution. So I'm happy to get those stories as they come in. And I tell you, I get a lot of referrals that don't pan out. People say, oh, I know someone. They told me this story. I'll tell them to contact you. They said it was okay to, you know, to give them their phone number, their email. People don't call me back. They don't email me back. People are very sensitive on this topic. There's not a lot of people who want to have me come out and record them, I've discovered. So I've been able to do a handful, I'd say over 10, 11, 12 at this point, over the last couple of years, which I've been able to actually get the information and record it and get transcripts for it. So I've been able to develop that. I'm still open to doing additional ones if they come in. But again, when people say, I know someone who really wants to talk to you, I've discovered that's not really true. I mean, people are still kind of afraid of the stigma, I think, about talking about these issues.
And assigning their name to it and so forth. On one level, I can understand this, but as an academic, I understand, and an archivist, I understand your point because you want a source for this, you want a provenance of this. So, you know, it adds to the veracity of the collection. Has the collecting, and this is always a tough thing to ask academic, because I see you as very much kind of non-biased. In other words, your job is to collect the story regardless if it's representative of the existence of Bigfoot or not. But has the collection and hearing these stories, has it changed your personal viewpoint at all about Bigfoot?
Well, there's been a lot of things that have had me think about Bigfoot because I've read, you know, quite a few books and seen a lot on TV, had a lot of conversations with skeptics and believers throughout my career beyond just being in academia. So my, you know, when I was a little boy, I think, yeah, Bigfoot's real. Bigfoot's for real. You know, it's absolutely true. So I'm older, it's like, well, I think Bigfoot's real. You know, I could see why people think it's not. And I could think of all the reasons why people would argue for the existence of Bigfoot. As I've gotten even older, though, I've gotten come to the realization that I really hope Bigfoot's out there. That would be awesome. That would be great. I'd really love to see a Bigfoot species. Also, the realization that at this point, it's probably not out there, at least not in a way that we can think of. It's unlikely you have a large primate wandering around all 49 of the 50 states and all the Canadian provinces and territories. And has been doing this for the centuries that we've had people in North America that have been recording it, and we still don't have any definitive proof. We can't think of any other animal like that out there, even rare species like wolverines, which you don't see very often. We have specimens, and we collect stuff. For some reason, people see Bigfoot all the time. You know, they're everywhere, but yet scientists can never quite get that thing that would prove that they're there. So I would love for there to be a reason why that we have not been able to get anything from what would have to be a viable breeding population that's widespread and it's huge and large and why we never see any of them. So I really hope that there's Bigfoot out there. But I, you know, at this point, you know, the burden of proof is really on people who claim that there's Bigfoot, and we really need to see some actual undeniable physical evidence like we would for any other species. There's, you know, we've got lots of species on this planet we prove exist. We can do the same thing for Bigfoot if Bigfoot's out there.
You know, it kind of depends for me on the day of the week that you ask me. One week I'm a total skeptic and it's like, no, exactly what you said. No bones, no DNA, no corpse. And then I know all of the justifications for that I hear from Bigfoot folk. They say, well, you know, nature takes care of its own and possibly Bigfoot buries its dead and blah, blah, blah. But you would think there would be some kind of physical proof. And then the next day I'll hear accounts or I'll rewatch the Patterson-Gimlin film Stabilized, and it almost looks like, to me, muscle tone. So it kind of depends on the day you ask me how I feel about Bigfoot. But it's undoubtedly fascinating and continues to fascinate me and you and millions of others. You had mentioned the chicken story. Is there another favorite Bigfoot account that you've collected?
Yeah, I would call it a sighting cluster. We have a small town in Schuyler County nearby, the town's Brooklyn. And there is a couple of neighbors that live close together that are all seeing or have been seeing Bigfoot. Most of the time they're describing Bigfoot, although one of them also says that they're running into a werewolf dogman too, that's also visiting. So I've been out there several times and I've interviewed several of them a couple of times. I think I've got like six different recorded interviews from six unique individuals at that one site in this neighborhood. And they've also got a bunch of really bad pictures, unfortunately, that really I can't really use. I did put a trail cam out by one of their properties and checked that for several months where they claimed Bigfoot was coming and peeking in a window. But evidently Bigfoot knew the camera was there and stopped peeking when I had it out there. But I got some stories that they are convinced that there's a Bigfoot family out there and it lives in a cave close to the cemetery in town. I did not go into the cave, but, I don't really want to go into a wild cave on my own, but, there's some interesting stories there. So that one really sticks out as one that we've had. So I've got those interviews recorded and transcribed so that people can see them.
I'm assuming not necessarily all, but a goodly amount of these people come across as very sincere.
And that's when you say, you know, some days you believe in Bigfoot, some days you don't. When I'm talking to people and they're telling me they saw Bigfoot, I'm believing them. You know, I don't think people are coming and lying to me. I mean, it's always a possibility that people are making these stories up, but I think they believe they saw this, that they saw something. And when they tell me they saw a big ape standing there in their backyard, I mean, there's other things it could be, but, you know, I have to take them seriously. You know, that I take, you know, eyewitnesses seriously. I realize that eyewitnesses are often wrong. I know people go to jail, you know, for long periods of time and then later they're exonerated because the witnesses identified the wrong person. You know, I know that police officers and military personnel can make mistakes. And I know that eyewitness testimony is not always reliable. People remember things differently than what they happened. People talk to each other and their memories will start to converge and they'll agree on a single memory. I know that if people watch a lot of shows about Bigfoot on TV, they know what a Bigfoot encounter is supposed to look like and what tree knocking is supposed to sound like and what Bigfoot signs are. And then when they have something they can't explain, they will interpret it through the lens of having saw those Bigfoot shows. So I know memory's not perfect. I mean, there's lots of reasons why what they're telling me didn't really happen that way, but I still believe them. I mean, I take their accounts very seriously, and I'm very open to the fact that they really saw Bigfoot. You know, I think I owe it to them, and that's who I am.
Now, there is an alternate explanation, because I think that I have always felt, and I think most people, when they think of Bigfoot, they think it's just another animal, if it exists. But some people, and I don't necessarily say I subscribe to this, but alternate theories are that it is some kind of interdimensional being or some kind of supernatural being that appears. What are your thoughts on that? And is that something that's kind of crept into some of these accounts?
Yeah, I have not had that creep into any of the accounts that I have taken, although I'm very much aware of the paranormal aspect that people often draw into Bigfoot. And my thought on that is, you know, basically when you're doing Bigfoot research, what are you doing? Are you trying to prove this is an animal? Are you going to really going into folklore? Because, I mean, we have accounts of beings that have interdimensional portals that pop in and out, you know, that can disguise themselves, that can make people confused and make themselves blurry. And can do all those things and call them fairies, the fae, you know. Sure. And so when you're talking about Bigfoot as an interdimensional being and you start just giving Bigfoot all these paranormal powers, you're basically describing Bigfoot as a fae being, a fairy. And that's fine. I don't have any problems if people want to go down that round of theory. That's great folklore. I'll collect it if someone tells me that story. I certainly recognize the value of those stories. You know, these go way back in human history, people describing those type of beings. However, that also gets back to academia, how, you know, being taken seriously. You know, it's hard to get people to take someone in academia seriously if they're doing Bigfoot research, even if they're sticking to a physical animal. But people can acknowledge that, okay, maybe if there's something there, you can find it.
Right.
I think academics would love to be able to go out and find Bigfoot. I mean, there's not any professors out there who thought they could find Bigfoot wouldn't do it. I mean, that would make your career. I mean, you're going to, people say, you know, scientists or academics don't want to rewrite the books. They're afraid to rewrite in history books or rewriting and stuff. That's ridiculous. They love to rewrite it because those new textbooks will have their names on them and they'll make lots of money. This isn't an issue. People, and people in academia are very competitive and they like to one up their competition and they like to prove things. So unorthodox theories are great and people will try to prove them. And we see academics, you know, working on the Bigfoot issue, some quietly, I'm sure. Because if there's something there, this is going to be great for their careers. But the reason they can't do it is because people do take it into that paranormal realm. You're not going to go to a conference and talk about physical evidence for Bigfoot if other people at that same conference are talking about portals that Bigfoot's jumping through, or they're proof that Bigfoot are descended of fallen angels. I mean, that's not going to help you as an academic. But, you know, that completely destroys any credibility of anywhere you present or anywhere that you want to publish it. And you really have to draw the line there. So if people want to go down that route, I'm respect that. I appreciate the folklore they're creating, but you're not going to get any serious scientific or academic recognition of those viewpoints.
Good point. Now, in terms of Bigfoot in Illinois versus Bigfoot in Washington, did you observe through your discussion with people about the subject, your research into it, did you find any meaningful differences? Or does it seem that if there is a creature, we're dealing with the same animal? And if it's just folklore, we're dealing with the same, essentially, folklore?
Yeah, I obviously, not being able to examine a Bigfoot specimen, their location, I could not tell you if it's the same species or if it's different versions of the same species. But they certainly seem similar. I mean, they seem to be describing the same creature. Seems to be sort of the same sort of encounter situations. Washington obviously is much more densely forested, you know, on the western side of the mountains there. Most of Whatcom County, where I lived in Washington, you know, outside of, you know, Bellingham and some of the small towns, is basically dense wilderness, you know, and it's easy to see something hiding out there that you know, behind that wall of forest. Illinois is also deeply wooded, heavily forested, at least in the southern central parts outside of Chicago when you get down into the southern western more parts of the state. And there's lots of places where Bigfoot could hide here too, but I would say it'd be a little harder to hide here. It's a little more densely populated as it's spread out. But there's lots of woodlands, there's lots of caves, there's lots of abandoned mines, there's places where a species could hide, but they'd still have to move around if they reproduce. I can't, you know, some single family couldn't stay in one location without some mobility, without a viable gene pool. So I think Illinois is like the top fourth state in Bigfoot sightings, and I can see that there's room here. But I do think it would be easier to hide in Washington than it would be in Illinois. I will say that if you're a Bigfoot and trying to stay hidden.
I really respect what you do collecting stories, also written and oral. Actually, we do a show called Campfire, which has been around for just about 14 years, and we just finished our 600th episode. And it is literally a show, a 90-minute show every week where people call in and share their stories of encounters with the supernatural. Now, you have the believers like me who think that many of these stories, there's really something to them. I think the vast majority of people who call into that show are being very authentic to their experience. Doesn't mean that every experience truly reflects supernatural explanations, but I find them fascinating. And I think whether they are things that have objectively occurred or not, even though I think many of them are, I think there's a value to collecting them. But that's my layperson's view. But as an academic, can you talk about the importance of the oral tradition, the importance of the written tradition, and cataloging stories of all types of what many people would call folklore?
Yeah, I think it's incredibly important that people be able to know what people have been telling, the stories that people have been telling around the campfire, as you would say, that what people were telling about what goes on in the woods. You know, when we read medieval accounts of fairy circles and people being taken out to fairyland, or people seeing accounts of the Green Man in England, you know, they're like Bigfoot, like being that was spotted, you know, back in medieval European folklore. When people talk about these different things that they saw in the natural world and how they explain them, I think it's very important that we record those. I mean, that doesn't mean they literally happened. We interpret things differently. It could be, you know, that someone saw something in the past and they thought it was an angel. And then 500 years later, they thought the same thing was a fairy. And 500 years later, they say it's an alien. You know, the interpretations of the experiences might change, but we're at least hearing the stories of people were seeing. And, you know, local history, local traditions, they get lost. You know, a few generations and the stories get changed as people move on. When they're actually written down, I think it really helps to see, okay, back in 1495 or in 2022, this is what people are saying about this event. So when people are talking about doing encrypted research, I always say, well, did you start at the local library in that area? Did you go to the archives? Did you go look at 19th century newspaper articles in the area? Were there accounts of wild men or gorillas in the area? Is there stuff that you can actually read about previous stuff that happened? Because if you go into some archives, you might actually find prior cryptid stories that people don't even know about. But if you ask the librarian archivist, they'll be able to pull things for you. And you'd be surprised what you might find if you go into those areas. So if I was going to go do a Bigfoot hunt in an area, I would start in the library and look in the archives and see what's already there, what locations were found, what stories were recorded. And that might give you an idea of maybe where to start, what you might want to be looking for. And the same thing with the folklore. What folklore is there? What can you find? Because that might tell you something about what people are saying. I mean, that doesn't mean they saw a Bigfoot, but they thought they saw a Bigfoot, and that's important. I think that's an important story to record and keep and be able to look at in the future.
Yeah, I applaud you for that very much. If somebody wanted to kind of follow your work and learn more about what you do, maybe hear you on some other podcasts, is there a place they could go on the internet to check out what it is you're doing?
Yeah, I don't really publicize myself a lot in this area. I mean, I've been on a couple podcasts. You mentioned a couple that came out there. I do have a Bigfoot in Illinois page that you can find at the university. I mean, if you type in my name on Google, Bigfoot Lorenzo in Illinois, it'll probably be the first one that comes up. Mm-hmm. And I have a link to some of the podcasts that I've done that are there and some information on doing research. And people can certainly contact me if they wanted to do so. Excellent. And people have contacted me through that page.
Excellent. Well, I think it's great what you're doing, and I love the objectivity, although you're probably more on the side of Bigfoot doesn't really exist, even though I think you'd like for him to. You're still very open and willing to hear new perspectives and also hear the stories and collect the stories, which I think is great whether Bigfoot is real or not. Our guest has been Dr. Michael Lorenzen of Western Illinois University. Dr. Lorenzen, thank you for your time and your expertise today.
Thank you as well. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning into the Cryptid Report. We appreciate it and keep looking out. There just may be a cryptid around the corner. Have a great week, everybody. Bye-bye.